This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
The morning paper on the breakfast table gave the news of the sinking of the Lusitania. I remember going downtown to business. The people on the streets and on the elevated train had something in their faces that was not the usual something. Everybody who came into the office, whether they spoke about the disaster or not, showed a realization of seriously experiencing something. That it meant war is what the faces said, if the tongues didn't. Leaving the office and going uptown about 6 o'clock, I took the 3rd Avenue L at the Hanover Square station. As I came on the platform, there was quite a crowd waiting for the trains, which had been blocked lower down. And while waiting there, a hand organ or hurdy-gurdy was playing on a street below. Some workmen sitting on the side of the tracks began to whistle the tune, and others began to sing or hum the refrain. A workman with a shovel over his shoulder came on the platform and joined in the chorus. And the next man, a Wall Street banker with white spats and a cane, joined in it. And finally, it seemed to me that everybody was singing this tune, and they didn't seem to be singing for fun, but as a natural outlet for what their feelings had been going through all day long. There was a feeling of dignity all through this. The hand organ man seemed to sense this and wheeled the organ nearer the platform and kept it up fortissimo. And the chorus sounded as though every man in New York must be joining in it. Then the first train came and everybody crowded in, and the song eventually died out, but the effect on the crowd still showed. Almost nobody talked. The people acted as though they might be coming out of a church service. In going uptown, occasionally little groups would start singing or humming the tune. Charles Ives.
Thank you. strange meeting. It seemed that out of a battle I escaped, down some profound, dull tunnel, long since scooped through granites which titanic wars had groined. Yet also there encumbered sleepers groaned, too fast in thought or death to be bestirred. Then, as I probed them, one sprang up and stared with piteous recognition and fixed eyes, lifting distressful hands as if to bless, and by his smile I knew that sullen hall. By his dead smile I knew we stood in hell. With a thousand fears that vision's face was grained, yet no blood reached there from the upper ground, and no guns thumped, or down the flues made moan. "Strange friend," I said, "here is no cause to mourn." "None," said that other, "save the undone years, the hopelessness. Whatever hope is yours was my life also. I went hunting wild after the wildest beauty in the world, which lies not in calm eyes or braided hair, but mocks the steady running of the hour. And if it grieves, grieves richlier than here. For by my glee might many men have laughed, and of my weeping something had been left, which must die now. I mean the truth untold, the pity of war, the pity war distilled. Now men will go content with what we spoiled, or discontent, boil bloody and be spilled. They will be swift with swiftness of the tigress. None will break ranks, though nations trek from progress. Courage was mine, and I had mystery. Wisdom was mine, and I had mastery, to miss the march of this retreating world into vain citadels that are not walled. Then, when much blood had clogged their chariot wheels, I would go up and wash them from sweet wells, even with truths that lie too deep for taint. I would have poured my spirit without stint, but not through wounds, not on the cess of war. Foreheads of men have bled where no wounds were. I am the enemy you killed, my friend. I knew you in this dark, for so you frowned yesterday through me as you jabbed and killed. I parried, but my hands were loath and cold. Let us sleep now. Second Lieutenant Wilfred Owen.
Thank you. I do not suppose that your troops are to be beaten in actual conflict with the foe, or that they will be driven into the sea. But I am certain that many homes in England, in which there now exists a fond hope that the distant one may return, many such homes may be rendered desolate when the next mail shall arrive. The angel of death has been abroad throughout the land. You may almost hear the beating of his wings. There is no one, as when the firstborn were slain of old, to sprinkle with blood the lintel and the two side posts of our doors, that he may spare and pass on. He takes his victims from the castle of the noble, the mansion of the wealthy, and the cottage of the poor and the lowly. And it is on behalf of all these classes that I make this solemn appeal. I tell the noble lord that if he be ready, honestly and frankly, to endeavor by the negotiations to be opened at Vienna to put an end to this war, no word of mine, no vote of mine, will be given to shake his power for one single moment, or to change his position in this house. I am sure that the noble lord is not inaccessible to appeals made to him from honest motives and with no unfriendly feeling. The noble lord has been for more than 40 years a member of this house. Before I was born, he sat upon the treasury bench, and he has devoted his life in the service of his country. He is no longer young, and his life has extended almost to the term allotted to man. I would entreat the noble lord to take a course which, when he looks back upon his whole political career, whatever he may therein find to be pleased with, whatever to regret, cannot but be a source of gratification to him. By adopting that course, he would have the satisfaction of reflecting that, having obtained the object of his laudable ambition, having become the foremost subject of the crown, the director of, it may be, the destinies of his country, and the presiding genius in her councils, he had achieved a still higher and nobler ambition, that he had returned the sword to the scabbard, that at his word torrents of blood had ceased to flow, that he had restored tranquility to Europe and saved this country from the indescribable calamities of war. John Bright.
Thank you. Thank you. Dear Sir Alexander, I am sending a few words which I have tried to write about George. I wish it was more worthy. If you would care to do so, please use part or all of it as you think best. I am sorry it is in pencil, but pens and ink are hard to come by here. I am enclosing George's letter from which I quote. I feel you may care to keep it. One of my most grateful memories of George is connected with my London Symphony. Indeed, I owe its whole idea to him. I remember very well how the idea originated. He had been sitting with us one evening, talking, smoking, and playing. At the end of the evening, just as he was getting up to go, he said in his characteristically abrupt way, "You know, you ought to write a symphony." From that moment, the idea of a symphony, a thing which I had always declared I would never attempt, dominated my mind. I showed the sketches to George bit by bit as they were finished. And it was then that I realized that he possessed, in common with very few composers, a wonderful power of criticism of other men's work and insight into their ideas and motives. I can never feel too grateful to him for all he did for me over this work. Another musical meeting around for George and myself was the English folk song, for which he did so much, and which did so much for him. It has often been my privilege to hear him improvise harmonies to the folk tunes which he had collected, bringing out in them a beauty and character which I had not realized when merely looking at them. This was not merely a case of clever harmonization. It meant that the inspiration which led to the original inception of these melodies, and that which lay at the root of Butterworth's art, were one and the same, and that in harmonizing folk tunes or using them in his compositions, he was simply carrying out a process of evolution of which these primitive melodies and his own art are different stages. When I first knew George's compositions, the traces of that individuality, which was so pronounced later on, were indeed to be found, but hindered and checked to a certain extent by the influence of Schumann and Brahms, and partly by what may be described as the Oxford manner in music. That fear of self-expression which seems to be fostered by academic traditions. It was the folk song which freed Butterworth's art from its foreign surroundings. To George Butterworth, the folk song was a means of freedom, which enabled him to throw off the fetters which hindered his earlier efforts and formed a nucleus which focused his hitherto vague stirrings after those things at which he really aimed. It is certain that his study of folk song coincided with the development of his real musical self. To him, the folk song as a basis of musical inspiration was not merely playing with local color, but their influence was no less clearly to be seen than in the idylls in which he definitely took folk music as the thematic basis. Indeed, he could no more help composing in his own national idiom than he could help speaking his own mother tongue. R. Vaughan Williams.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.